You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Yeah, troll on in indeed. As a matter of fact, sometimes when we talk to our WP Council segment, we're not talking about trolling at all. But we are today. We're once again spending some time with Dr. Mark Fitchett. He is the Pelagic Fisheries Ecosystem Scientist at the council, and trolling is his middle name. And we're going to talk about a lot of things today. And you know, I first of all want to begin, as we did early in the program, and I mentioned we're going to be talking to Mark in a bit. Mark, is just to reflect on the phenomenon, the almost the cult following that this whale carcass has, that everybody, when I say everybody, all the sharks and the fishies have been chomping on, must be terrific. What's the sort of scuttlebutt down at the office about this phenomenon?
Well, I think we're it's of interest. Everybody's kind of talking about it. Mm-hmm. You don't even need to be in fisheries to be talking about it. And people, folks on Waikiki have been, are definitely kind of at ground zero. But we're noticing that a lot of people getting in the water and taking photos of it, and which is, you know, good to bring awareness for sharks too. And there's a lot of there are two big sharks that are kind of gained a little bit of fame. There's a Deep Blue, which was tagged off Guadalupe Island, and there's another scientist here in Hawaii by the name of Michael Domeyer. Mm-hmm. He's in the Big Island, and he's tracked a lot of these sharks, and I think he's probably the biggest expert on all of great whites.
Amazing, and this particular animal, they say Deep Blue, might be pregnant.
Well, I think I looked on, I was on Facebook and Twitter and following, or Instagram and following my colleagues at the University of Miami, as well as Michael Domeyer, and I don't know if it's conclusive if the shark is necessarily pregnant. And there's also another shark that people are confusing. There's another shark that kind of appeared, according to Mike Domeyer's Facebook, a shark that was named Howley Girl.
I read about that the other day, too.
Yeah.
But you know what I think is incredibly interesting to me, and maybe you can explain this. This is such a huge, big piece of meat. In other words, I guess it was, before it was discovered, it had probably been dead for a couple of weeks, maybe even longer. But, you know, with all the video that we've seen and all of these apex predators just banging away at it, it's still very big. So I don't think people really understand exactly how much food that is.
Yeah, and these things are pretty large, and it's sort of a smorgasbord for a lot of all-you-can-eat buffet for a lot of apex predators. There's a lot of fat content, nutrition for these big fish.
Yeah. Who are eating machines, right?
Who are eating machines.
They're going to hang around as long as there's food.
And, you know, going also, you know, last night or the other day, I was following, you know, some of the conversations online with Mike Domeyer and some of the other shark experts. And I think, they said, well, somebody asked, well, how long until the shark eats again? And, they said probably just a few weeks, because these things have pretty high metabolisms.
Yeah. That's a really good point. I mean, some people think that maybe Deep Blue was pregnant. Others are saying, no, she or he is just full.
That could be the case. It could be the body condition of the shark as well, due to satiation. Who knows? It's inconclusive to say whether or not the shark is pregnant. I mean, just based on photographs alone.
But, what I get fascinated with, and maybe you can address that a bit, and that is just when you take a look at a sleek shark and then you take a look at a fat one, you think, how often do these things have to eat? Surprising what you said is, if they gorge on a lot of stuff, it can be a long time between meals.
It could be. Some folks were saying, oh, it's going to be a long time, like is in an order of months, and that's kind of crazy. These things do.
They
got to eat. They migrate a long ways. And their metabolism is a little bit is much faster than that. So, these things are going to eat to or from or past the point of satiation, but they're going to definitely take advantage of this meal. So,
well, you know, a friend of mine called me on my regular show the other day and said, you know, when you watch a horror movie, when the guy's going up into the attic and everybody in the audience goes, don't go in the attic, you know. And what about the same thing? I do know that you all at the council and everybody in Dobor and Docare and Marine Police, everybody is really saying to people, look, this thing is not an amusement park out there. There's some serious carnage that can happen to you, your body, if you take your little camera in there and try to get a picture.
And I agree, you know, but at the same time, you know, there are professionals who know what they're doing.
Yep.
And so I'll let them do their job, and I'm not going to quarterback and tell them, you know, people who take photos, because it's good to at least document and to bring awareness to sharks for education and things like that. But when you get folks in there who are going on and essentially grabbing onto the shark, harassing it, kind of you're crossing the line there, and it sends a wrong message.
Mark and I are talking on Friday. I want to tell you that last night, I was watching the CBS News with Glore and at the 5:30 report, and it had that video of Deep Blue in there. In other words, it went viral, and this whole thing is attracting a tremendous amount of interest. But what you say is true. There's some pros that are really good at that.
Yes,
and we need them to document these things.
And I agree, 100%. You know, and there's been a lot of online chatter and people bickering, and there's, you know, there's the folks here in Hawaii who know what they're doing. Yep. There, you know, there's some charter guys and gals who've been taking photos and documenting things, and they do a good job. And then you get sort of the vanity aspect of a few people who want to, you know, who are profiteering off of it just for you know, social media likes or essentially at the expense of possibly of the animal by grabbing onto it, and you know,
it's awful. Yeah. You know, and by the way, just an unabashed plug for my column, The Buck Stops Here, in Hawaii Boats and Yachts. You know, I'm working on it as we speak today. Dr. Filchin and I are recording here on Friday for Saturday the 19th. Early next month, you're going to see some great pictures by my friend Kali Kamasugi, who is one of the pros who we're talking about that does this documentation. But what I think it was funny, because when I found out that Mark and I were going to be talking about a study, there are some great studies going on right now about this animal, this carcass, and all of these things that are eaten on it. So in some ways, what we're going to talk about today sort of parallels what everybody's thinking about. But today we're going to talk a little bit about one of my favorite subjects, and that is big eye tuna, and do we have a local family of tuna or not? What's happening with what you're doing? What's coming up this week that you can share with us about big eye?
Well, we're, you know, doing a lot. There's two major issues right now pertaining to big eye tuna that we're trying to get some biological sampling from the Hawaii and from the Central North Pacific to represent the many of the studies going on right now. And there's a friend and colleague of mine down in Australia, Peter Grew. He spent some time up here in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And so one of the studies that he's working on is looking at using genetic techniques on fine scale time scales to determine how much mixing and how much how do you best structure biological units of big eye tuna in the Pacific.
When you say biological units, you're talking about a large group of fish in a certain place.
A large group of fish that may be mating and you have gene flow. So if you have fish that move, so you may have a tuna that may move from here to Timbuktu, but that fish doesn't spawn with fish over, let's say, in the Western Pacific or the Eastern Pacific. How much mixing? And the way to look at that is looking at genetics. And so we're looking for it's really interesting stuff, and we're actually trying to get from some of our troll fishermen who do happen to run into small juvenile big eye about 20 inches or less, and getting some muscle tissue samples from them, shipping them off to Pete, and for us to work on and to work on our study.
What's the advantage of getting the tissue from that size fish?
That's a good question, Mike. You know, the reason being is that if you small tunas usually have a little bit more residency from where they were spawned. So if we have a small tuna that is you know, not even a year old, 20 inches or less. These fish getting some sort of we're under the assumption that they were spawned at least within a reasonable distance from the Hawaiian island chain.
Okay, is it you are what you eat? So you can tell that fish from that area? Maybe it's specifically identifiable because of the food that it was eating?
Well, people have done that's another good question. Folks have done looking at stable isotope analysis to compare food and diet among regions, and that's an important, you know, study to do. But the big thing here, the main I would say the most indisputable way to distinguish between organisms and how biological different they are, besides mm-hmm. just, you know, looking at the fish and looking at some of the externalities, is genetics. Genetics is one of the most important way, one of the most important and most powerful ways to differentiate stocks. So that's why getting some of these small fish with our troll fisheries that may not travel beyond 100 miles from shore. We're looking for folks who are catching fish 100 miles or less from shore.
Yeah, and this let me tell you why this is key. Well, we'll get into it. Dr. Fitzhead is into this. We'll call him Mark, just because I want to make sure that you understand. He's just like us, except he's more studied in an area. I think one of the biggest difficulties some of us have is identifying a big eye or a yellowfin. I mean, you know, they're so similar.
Yes.
And I do know that at a young age, they're probably even more similar. Are they?
They are. Yeah. They're kind of hard to tell apart. Mm-hmm. I even struggle sometimes. Yeah. Dave Atano, who's a biologist here. Yeah. You know him. He's
a great guy.
He's probably the foremost expert in telling them apart. But some simple ways are just looking at the body markings. So if you have a big eye and yellowfin of the same size, looking at the markings, so you know how they have these markings, sort of these stripes.
Right.
Big eye tuna have more evenly spaced, sort of more or less straight lines, and then yellowfin have more evenly spaced, but sort of a chevron shape.
Yeah, what you got to do is you got to go to wpconsul.org, and you got to take a look. If you go to wpconsul.org, you'll be able to see relatively easily the size, right? As far as the size, and I've also what I learned from David was that they're a little bit lengthier. The big eye is a little bit longer looking than the shibi at a certain age.
They may. I know sometimes there are some different body morphometrics. I can tell you that relatively speaking, from the shape of the eye, the size of the eye, relative to the fork, the width of the fish, but also if you have a couple apart and you say, well, there's four big eye and four yellowfin, you can just look at the shape of the eye versus the shape of the body and the tail fork.
That's a great point. And by the way, you can see that when you do go to the auction.
Yeah.
It really is terrific. And that's one of the few times when you can see two adults, you know, and you can say, well, that's a big eye.
Oh,
and that's a yellowfin. You
know? When they're small, it's even harder,
a lot harder.
You know, you got to look at the, you know.
So, but I mean, we've talked about the cochlear, the ears and all of this stuff. What can you learn from the tissue?
So looking at the tissue samples, what we're looking to do is to get, anywhere between 24 to 96 samples that's the sample size that Peter wanted me to look after. We're looking at we're getting some muscle tissue for these small fish to get the DNA from them.
Okay. Now, when you say that, let's say the fisherman wants to participate and just hears this.
Yeah.
What does he do? Does he keep the whole fish? I mean, is there specific instructions on what part? How can the guy get involved?
Well, if they want to contact us, we can go and meet them here, because we are a small island here. So here, especially here in Oahu, I can drive out. But also, if they're anticipating, they've been catching some and they want to get on the phone and call us, you know, just getting online and sending us an email, looking us up here at wpcouncil.org. Getting in touch with us, and we can arrange either picking up fish, or if they're keen to it, we just need a piece of muscle tissue about the size of a pea. So, and more towards the tail end, just a small piece of tissue. We actually been getting we got some in Maui this weekend. Eric Kingma went to Maui, stayed with his family, and then took some pieces of tissue about the size of a pea, and more towards the tail end of the fish, because we don't want to, we don't want to damage the aesthetics of the fish if they want to sell.
Interesting. And by the way, I don't know if you know the level of gratitude that these guys have, right? I mean, seriously, about people that are willing to participate in that. But more importantly, I don't know if what information you need from the fisherman besides the tissue sample. Obviously, where he caught it.
Where they caught it.
At least in a gray area. Nobody's going to give you their exact GPS crossroads, but they're going to give you a pretty good idea, right?
Well, usually just a general 1 degree lat lawn, so we can at least, when we report it to Peter, we can give him a latitude and longitude. Not necessarily, to the exact minute, 1 degree resolution is 60 miles, but 60 miles, give or take. So that's kind of the resolution we're looking for.
So that's fairly easy for people to gather. What's the point of the study, the point of the test is, you said earlier off the air, we're looking at DNA analysis.
Right.
What is the value of this science? I mean, what are you trying to, what sort of logbook, if you will, are you trying to compile on this?
You know, so taking a step back and looking at the work that's being done and currently been done in the Pacific, there's a program called by the SPC, the Secretariat of the Pacific, Community has the tuna, is what's called a tuna tissue bank, and they don't really have many samples from Hawaii in the Central Pacific, and so they have this immense amount of information in the Western Southern Pacific, but not a lot of information here in Hawaii. And so we're trying to fill that knowledge void so they can do more of a more accurate mosaic of looking at the genetic structure geographically, and then also through time. So we want to, this is not just a one shot deal. We want to do this, you know, every year, every other year, so forth, to look at how that's changed over time, because you know that fish don't necessarily stay stationary through each lifespan.
We know where the grids are, but they don't. Here's something that I found interesting, though, and this is ever since our hooking up with the WP Council back several years ago when they became one of the sponsors of our program, was that a lot of this information is giving us reason to believe that we were kind of incorrect about where the fish come from. That a lot of people in Hawaii thought for many, many years that it was the sea, the Japan current or whatever, brought the yellowfin, brought the big eye. But then we found out, no, we got yellowfin. You know, we have a resident, you know, documentable yellowfin fishery. What about big eye? I mean, is there science now to suggest that we also might have our own big eye?
We very well might have our own big eye stock. One of the hypotheses that was pushed even in the Eastern Pacific by scientists at the Inter-American Tropical Tuna Commission was that, hey, you know, we're going to start looking at data to do our stock assessments west of X grid, because we think that most likely these are Hawaii fish and there's a resident Hawaii population. Yeah. The same thing at in Noumea, and I was in New Caledonia in October, and one of the hypotheses pushed forward is that we may have a Central Pacific stock, maybe from the Line Islands all the way to Hawaii.
I find that fascinating for a couple of reasons. First of all, I do know that we've talked before about whether the Papahanaumoku is a nursery or not. Are we getting fish that are bred there and then they come up? And there's now science to say, no, wait a minute, we probably have our own. But what about these fish that you say that are migratory, that come through every year when there's a run? Do some of our guys join some of their guys? Do some of their guys stay here? That's all interesting, isn't
it? And there's two ways of looking at that. There's tagging. Tagging is looking at fish flow, how fish move. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking about spawning and sort of self, and you're looking at stock productivity, which is important for stock assessment, you need to start looking at gene flow. How much spawning and mixing do maybe one group of fish have with another?
That's fascinating. And by the way, it's not just for being curious. It's because you can solve a lot of issues take a look at this stuff. I maybe, you know, want to also say this. When you catch albacore or tumbo in Hawaii, you usually never see a juvenile. Usually you see like a 50 or 60 pounder. You don't see the little ones.
Yeah.
Doesn't the presence of the baby big eye and yellowfin suggest that they're from here? I mean, how do these little fish, can these little fish, you know, 5-pound fish, can they travel across the ocean?
And, you know, some of the smaller tunas do travel the furthest. They actually found that skipjack tuna, which is the smaller.
Yeah, little aku.
Yeah, the little akus, the smaller tunas, they found that their lifetime movement rate is actually greater than those of the bigger tunas.
Amazing, huh?
So size doesn't necessarily mean you travel greater distances.
No, but it must mean that there are millions of them in the group.
There's a lot.
Because a lot of them are being picked off on their way, right?
They're getting picked up on their way. They're food for people and for and for other fish.
So, I mean, but what I'm getting at is the more we know, the more we know. And obviously, we've already seen some changes. For instance, and this was part to do with a lot of the science and the stock assessments made by the council on some of our deep seven, the bottom fish. Some of the Kapu areas are now being reopened. I mean, it's suggested it's sustainable. The end use here of this information that you're trying to do and update annually on the Big Eye, what is it? I mean, is it to determine sustainability, stock assessments? What's the study for?
Well, there's two main purposes. One of them is when we conduct our stock assessments, when the science provider does these stock assessments, how should they be drawing the lines, if you speak, of where, so we have data from, you know, X degree grid from all over the Pacific, where, how do we create different groups when, how do we treat them when we're looking at catch rates, and we were going to put all these indices in this more holistic stock assessment. That's one point. Second point is, okay, well, we can at least see how fish flow, all right, how much they move, and how susceptible they're being caught from other fleets throughout the entire Pacific. But then you have the gene flow. So is this one area an entity that produces its own fish versus, let's say, another area
waiting
over here
for somebody that's just swimming by?
And on top of that, you also have the amount of fish that move in and out of the region. So you need to look at defined stock by both these, by also fish flow, but also by gene flow.
Here's an interesting one. And by the way, Dr. Mark Fitchett is here with us, and we're talking about what's happening in the Big Eye tuna thing. But what I was thinking about during the same time when you're saying that is, this holds true for other species as well. And for instance, I do know that when they do like the point in time for the homeless community, did they do a 3-day period? Where did you sleep that night? It must be way more difficult to do an assessment based on fish stocks when you have, number one, geographically so many millions of miles, and number two, you want to make sure that you don't want to comp the same huge population of fish more than once.
That's true. You don't want to make sure that your indices, so in stock assessment, we use what's called catch per unit effort. We also have total catch. So we look at the sort of the many of the nuances of trends, how these trends differ catch relative to catch rate. These assessment, which can be complicated, understanding how we treat our data is often contingent on some biological information, and that's really, really important.
I kind of think that the ability to do these stock assessments has been so improved by technology, and I think that we're all starting to learn a bit about it. We were talking off the air. You also have, because of your pelagic, the fact that Mark's title is Pelagic Fishery Ecosystem Scientist. I want to talk about one of my favorite fish. We do know that there's been an effort underfoot on the mainland by many to restore the availability of billfish from Hawaii that don't seem to be endangered. Let's talk a little bit about stripies, because, you know, stripies come and go. If you're trolling out there, every now and again, you get a stripey attack. They just jump all over. 5 stripies bite you all at once. Of course, most of them spit the lure out, but at least they get hooked up. What's so magic about stripey? What are you doing with that right now?
So striped marlin are enigmatic. They're really, really, really important to Hawaii for our troll fishery. They're a non-target species in our longline fleet.
Yep.
So there's some marketability.
It's bycatch sometimes.
But, yeah. The curious thing about striped marlin is that our inshore, our shallow set longline fishery and our troll fishery, we see these, and just looking at the data, in fact, this is where I probably need to be talking more to the troll fishermen to see, you know, is this something I need to do part of my job? But one of the things we're seeing are these huge spikes in catch rates and many of our other fisheries. But looking at the troll data, you're seeing the same thing. You see a lot of variability. Yeah. And accounting for that could be environmental. Could be that maybe environmental conditions do bring fish closer to the island chain, so they're more susceptible to being caught in our fisheries. And there's also the other issue, you know, with striped marlin, stock structure, like same with Big Eye tuna. We assume that there's this magical line in the ocean, that we're going to draw the lines on stock assessment based on just those, on, let's say, our tuna RFMOs, our regional management fishery management organizations. We use those, or we can look at using stock structure information genetics. And there's been a study by Catherine Purcell and Edmonds at Southwest Fishery Science Center in La Jolla that showed that there may be a local striped marlin, or at least Central Pacific striped marlin population.
See, that was my next question. I'll tell you why. Everybody knows it's listening, and you know me, I'm a troller. Local fishermen, we love stripies because they're handleable. They're small.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you can, what if you get 125 pounder, that's a big one. You know, I mean, most of these stripies are, you know, anywhere from 50 to, what, 80, 90, 100 pounds, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And most of them go right in the fish box. Most of us can clean them pretty easily, and there's no waste. And they're just a great eating fish. There's something about the texture. There's something about the desirability. That's why we love catching them.
Yeah, and they're fun to catch. You see these huge aggregations off Mexico. They're catching 100 a day.
Yeah.
And they're catching so many that they become a nuisance.
Mm-hmm.
And
bring them right to my freezer.
Exactly. Yeah, but we've seen tagging trajectories from fish that go from Mexico, California to here. But unfortunately, the way we're managing the fish stock right now is we're managing it as a Western and Central North Pacific stock, not really accounting for things in the Eastern Pacific.
Wow.
And one of the things we've been working on now, and I've been very, very passionate about, is looking at the differences in size of striped marlin.
Yeah, you know, instead of listening to what I said, let's listen to the doc. I mean, you know, for instance, what is a stripey on the small side that gets caught?
A striper on a small side that gets caught. So looking at eye fork length, from the eye to the tip of the tail, a small 0 to 1 year old fish is anywhere between 70 centimeters. So it's about a meter and a half. It can be anywhere between a meter to 75 centimeters, which is a fairly decent sized fish.
And
that's a juvenile.
And the weight of that juvenile is about what?
The weight of the juvenile is, anywhere between, I would say, 10 to 12 kilos.
I have seen, and that's kilos, by the way. I knew he was going to say that. So you're looking at 25 pounds.
Yeah.
And I don't see, personally, I maybe others do, I can't remember seeing too many smaller than that. I don't know where they are up until that size, but you don't seem to see them.
Well,
and then there's a space between that 25 pounds and 125 pounds.
And the reason you see these, you get these smaller fish, they're very fast growers.
Yeah.
So the very, very small ones are probably not necessarily targeted or catchable in troll fisheries. You're not going to catch a lot because they may not take a bait. But a lot of these small striped marlin, one of the issues here is looking at the bigger picture, is that striped marlin here do grow very fast, but their maximum size may be much smaller than elsewhere in the Pacific. In the Southwest Pacific, you're seeing fish from eye fork length that are close to 3 meters.
Yeah,
that is a ginormous striped marlin.
Yeah, 6 feet,
And that is down the Coral Sea and then down off Australia. Mm-hmm. They catch really, really big ones. And then perhaps in Taiwan, where the only existing growth study, which is used in assessing the stock, those fish grow a little bit smaller, about 230 centimeters eye fork length. But here, on some data that we've been analyzing here in Hawaii, we actually found that those fish may grow less than 2 meters, about 180 centimeters eye fork length. And you rarely get many that are above 60 kilos here.
Yeah, which is 120 pounds.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's right. That's what I said. At the upper scale, 125 pound stripe is a pretty big fish.
That's a huge striped marlin.
It has tremendous value because it is nowhere near as oily as some of its tuna cousins, and yet it is also more tender than some of the bigger marlin, some of the Pacific blue. So that makes them a very desirable fish, and that they're easier to handle. It's easier to buy a slab and take it to your restaurant and cook it. I mean, there's a lot of advantages to that, and one of them has been that we had a pretty good market outside of Hawaii for the stripies, and now we don't.
Yeah, and part of the reason could also be due to the Billfish Act, the interstate. The laws that are prohibiting the interstate sale of billfish from Hawaii, it's just hurting here. It was to get on my soapbox, it was proposed by two congressmen in Florida, one of which is supported by the sugar industry, yeah, which is responsible for that huge fish kill in Florida. Mm-hmm. But he used this as a sort of a token to greenwash his own,
yeah,
a political, rather than get in the weeds of my political, yeah, you know, yeah, the politics of it. It was brought to the Congress and was passed recently to get rid of the Hawaii exemption, which only hurts Hawaii. It doesn't, yeah, necessarily help billfish.
No, it doesn't. And, no, I don't see it. No.
It doesn't, because if they're going to get a billfish, a lot of the in looking at records from Central America, so many billfish have been made its way from Central America to Florida in the Florida supermarkets. Those yeah, fish that you're finding in Florida supermarkets, they ain't Hawaii fish.
Yeah, because it's amazing.
When a fish leaves here from Hawaii, it had a piece of paper with it. Mm-hmm. So we were able to track where that fish goes.
By the way, that piece of paper that he's talking about, if you go to the United Fish Agency auction, and I've taken thousands of people through there through the years, every single fish has a UPC barcode. Every single fish. And the reason for that, Mark, and I know you've heard this before, but I want to make sure the audience knows. Let's say that a fancy restaurant in New York has a problem with something, you know, something, yeah, maybe they got a bad piece of fish. Like a heat-seeking missile, you can find out exactly where that thing came from, who caught it, when they caught it, when it was tabled, when it was auctioned, when it flew, all from that little tag. Amazing, isn't it?
And that's for some species, yeah, of fish. I know in the Southeast, it's been a big issue with the looking at identifying even the trip that, so pretty, yeah, much from the, yeah, from the boat to the table to the plate, mm, they've been able to trace. So the issues with seafood traceability are of interest not only for interstate commerce, international, mm, commerce, but also food safety. And these are
also value. I mean, yeah, we do know that here in Hawaii, knock on wood, we say this, and you fishermen out there, we're not saying this to make you feel good. It's a known fact that we seem, particularly at the United Fisheries auction, the fish, we take pretty good care of our fish because it matters how much money you're going to get for it.
Yep.
You know? Absolutely. That's pretty interesting. Okay, so in a nutshell, there's certain parallels. Let's ask you about this other study that you're doing, the stock structure that you're doing with stripies. What's the what do you hope to achieve as far as awareness based on your study?
Well, the structure, the study that we worked on here at Council was we were looking at aging growth. Mm-hmm. So we're actually looking at size differences between striped marlin here and then comparatively, yeah, to other parts of the Pacific. The reason why that's important is that in stock assessments, growth is an important input, mm-hmm, into assessments. So if you're assuming that fish may grow to a certain size or have a certain growth rate, you could be, in essence, underestimating the age of the fish.
Okay.
And, yeah, then in turn, perhaps coming up with more of a negative outcome in the stock assessment. You may be overestimating exploitation rate.
Okay, just to make sure that you know what we're talking about here, because I want to leave on a positive note. Mark Fitzit is the Pelagic Fishery Ecosystem Scientist for the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council. And what we're looking at today, outside of informing you about these studies, is how you can participate with tissue samples eventually for DNA analysis, which is going to help Mark and other scientists all over the place make some pretty important some pretty important information available to everybody in the fishery. So if somebody wants to do that, first of all, you're looking for juvenile big eye tissue samples.
Juvenile big eye tissue samples, 20 inches roughly or less, mm-hmm, caught 100 miles from any of the Hawaiian Islands. And then if they can just give a general lat and long, yeah, yeah, 1 degree, that would be good for us and to contact, mm-hmm, us. And then, you know, and even I can, you know, my email address, yeah, my personal email address is mark.fitchett. So it's M-A-R-K. .FITCHETT at WPCouncil.org.
Yep. And I want to tell you why this is good. And just a parting, the last question is, let's say that somebody hears this and they remember it and they're out fishing and they say, hey, this meets the criteria. Obviously, you want to take care of it. You want to make sure you get it iced. You want to make sure it's in good shape. And then what?
And then what? They can contact us and, yeah, then we could do one of two things. Yeah. I could go and meet them, mm-hmm, and take a sample from, yeah, it. And then alternatively, if they know they're going to be catching some, I can leave some vials and kind of tell them what
that's
we need.
That's where I want to get.
Yeah.
Those of you that are out there often.
Because they may not want to deal with me, you know, and I respect that because sometimes fishermen, you know, they want to keep everything sort of under wraps.
On the down low.
On the down low, which is understandable. I mean,
of course, we're all like that.
There's a little bit of intrusion issues there. I don't want to really, you know, overstep, but it would be good to you know, to get some input from our troll fisheries. And one thing we need to do is we need to incorporate our smaller fleet, small boat, tuna boat, small boat, troll boats, get them more involved and give them a voice as well.
You guys, you hear that? That's you guys now. And remember, any of these things you have a question about, the easiest way to get an answer, and I'll send you Mark's information, his email, and tell you about WPCouncil.org, but drop me a line, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. themikebuckshow@gmail.com. Thanks, everybody, for giving us all that good scoops on the shark and the sharks and the whale carcass. We'll see you next time. Have a great weekend. Aloha.